Horton fail. I was scrambling to find the clip of Ike Eisenhower, the short version, about how if we're to be free, we must resist the influence of the people who make the weapons over the government that uses the weapons. You know, it was his last day in office, and it was way too little too late after he'd built thousands of hydrogen bombs and taken over half the world and overthrown legitimate governments in Guatemala and Iran and God knows where else. And then this bloody-handed monster said, "By the way, I've left you a force in American life that you'll never be able to undo again. Good luck, everybody." And then turned it over to the, you know, Mr. Missile Gap and Mr. Escalation, right-wing Democrat John F. Kennedy. So here we are, stuck with this madness. It's not the military-industrial complex anymore. It's not even the military-industrial-congressional complex anymore, which is what Ike wanted to call it in the speech in the first place. Now it's just the complex. Now it's the American economy, the American way of life. And our guest is Nick Turse, and he's the author of The Complex, How the Military Invades Every Bit of Our Society. I'm sorry, I forgot the rest of the subtitle. Welcome to the show, Nick. How the hell are you?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Everybody, you can find Nick at nickturse.com. That's T-U-R-S-E, nickturse.com. You can read him at Tom Dispatch and at Alternet. Right now, he's in the middle of a book, right? Kill Anything That Moves, about Vietnam?
Yes. That book's in the works. And then I have a new edited collection that's just come out.
Right on. All right. So tell us about this complex. Draw a picture of this thing so that people can understand this quasi-free market we have in this country.
Well, in the complex, you know, what I look at is something that I, you know, it's akin, I say in the book, to the Matrix of the movies. It's something that you know, invades, you know, every facet of our everyday lives. Yeah, you know, this is you know, it's not the military-industrial complex of Ike's era. This is something much larger, much more insidious, and its tentacles are everywhere, from you know, the corporations that supply the food in our grocery store shelves to the studios that make the movies that everyone goes and watches.
Well, now, how can that be? I mean, I guess, well, first of all, start with the movies there. If I remember right, and it's been quite a long time, but didn't Karl Rove take a trip out here to L.A. in, say, late 2001, early 2002, and remind them of the bad old days and how we don't want it to be like that anymore, do we?
Yeah, you know, the military's made a major effort when it comes to movies. You know, it used to be done on an ad hoc basis, and I mean, their influence in Hollywood goes back to the silent era. But in recent years, you know, they've taken it up not just one notch, many. Right now, they rent an entire floor of an office building in Los Angeles, where they have special media liaison offices for each of the service branches: the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and the Department of Defense writ large. And what they do is they offer their services to Hollywood studios. If you want to make a big budget blockbuster, one of those big summer movies like Transformers or an Iron Man, and you want the latest military hardware, you submit your script to them. They'll look it over. If they see anything objectionable, they'll make the changes and tell you what needs to be done so that you can get a hold of this this glitzy taxpayer-funded hardware that isn't available anyplace else in the world.
Well, so give us a rough ballpark. Are we talking about over, say, I don't know, the last 20, 30 years, are we talking about tens of movies, dozens, hundreds, thousands of movies have been influenced this way by the Pentagon?
Yeah, it goes into the hundreds. I mean, this is the way that business is done in Hollywood these days.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned Transformers specifically, because I went and saw Transformers with a young boy who's very important to me in my family, who I won't identify any more specifically than that. And I took him to see that, and it started out with a giant Army commercial, And I said to him, but really loud so the whole place could hear me, "Wow! So if I join the army, I get to stay in, I guess, what looks like Tennessee the whole time. And there's no Iraq or Afghanistan in the commercial at all. Join the military, you get to ride around on the back of a C-130 goofing off all day. It's great fun," was what the commercial said. And then we had a long talk after the movie was over about how every single thing in that movie is a Lockheed product. And that is not an accident. And this is not about defending us. And why the hell does America have a base in Bahrain anyway, young man? You need to ask yourself that. And you know what? I love Transformers. I grew up, I was the biggest Transformers fan in the whole world when I was in fourth grade. And I felt really betrayed by that personally, to be honest. But anyway, so I don't know if you have anything more to say about that specific subject, but I mean, that's really powerful propaganda about what fun a F-22 fighter's gotta be. And you know, I used to, I was what, 10 or 11 when Top Gun came out, and the first thing I did was go home and play F-14, man.
Sure, I think we were all there at one point.
So, yeah. Well, now talk about the food on the grocery store shelves, because I think this is a good example. You know, we could even be talking about shoes. We could be talking about anything, right? Pretty much any real successful business in this country, part of their business plan has to be sell things to the Pentagon.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge market, and, you know, just about everyone's in it from, you know, it's almost impossible to walk down you know, a grocery store aisle and not find you know, the shelves just filled with products that are somehow wrapped up with the Pentagon. You know, it's a great way for these companies to make easy money. Pentagon pays, you know, top dollar, and you know, without an anti-war movement in this country, without you know, a popular discussion on what a military contractor really is, they're able to, you know, get away with this without people really having any idea of the companies that they're supporting.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really the parallel, or like the more specific case, I guess, that comes up in my mind is, you know, when Chalmers Johnson talks about, okay, so they make whatever B-2 bomber, B-12, whatever, I forgot they call them, that's the vitamin. Anyway, they make these bombers and they have one part made in every single congressional district in the country if they can, in order to, you know, spread that, the demand for the jobs to keep the thing going out, so that no regional collection of congressmen could ever agree to shut something down and cost them. But the real, where the rubber really meets the road, it seems like, is, you know, the tube sock company lobbyists. They don't want an end of the war either, man. They're selling massive tube socks to this thing. And they, if it came down to it, they're imperialists. They got to get those socks sold. And this is the most important captive market of all. And so that, it just shows how the incentive structure, the whole society, has been completely distorted by this.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. It's, I mean, this is the way it's been set up for a reason. So
it's amazing stuff. Well, I highly recommend everybody read the book. It's called The Complex, How the Military Invades Our Everyday Lives. And again, I'm talking with Nick Terse. The website is nickterse.com. And a couple minutes here before we hit our break. So I want to, I guess, just introduce your article here at Alternet. It's alternet.org, 5 jaw-dropping stories in WikiLeaks archives begging for national attention. And that taxi theme song means I was off by about a minute and a half. We had about 30 seconds left. So this is the article we'll be discussing after the break. It's at alternet.org. It's Nick Terse. It's anti-war radio, and we'll be back in a minute.
This is the Liberty Radio Network, broadcasting the latest liberty-oriented audio content 24 hours a day at lrn.fm.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Wrapping up the show for the day and the week here with Nick Terse. His website is nickterse.com, T-U-R-S-E, nickterse.com. The book is The Complex, And you can find his articles at Tom Dispatch as well as alternet.org, where he's got a new one called Five Jaw-Dropping Stories in WikiLeaks Archives Begging for National Attention. And, you know, I don't know how to craft a perfect segue to this or anything, but the point is that America is a global empire, and the military-industrial complex and the associated distorted economy and the biggest parts of all of that have us on this crusade to take over the world, basically. Not that it's working out very well, and not that it's possible with giant powers like Russia and China refusing to give up their independence to us, but anyway, they're going to try anyway. And they have been, and the way that they get away with the worst of their deeds is secrecy. And that's what it's all about. Barack Obama continues to rack up victories defending George Bush's secrecy policies. And on we go. It's like Bush's third term. And so that's why WikiLeaks is so important, of course, and I think it's great that Nick Turse is one of the few people who actually decided to go and dig through that site and see what all's on there besides the collateral murder video, besides the Afghan war logs. What did you find, Nick?
Well, you know, I look at the site on a regular basis, and I always note that one thing that WikiLeaks really offers a lot of are U.S. counterinsurgency manuals. Now, the war that we're fighting in Afghanistan is run right, you know, by the book. And here's the inside story of exactly the type of war that's being waged there. And WikiLeaks offers no fewer than eight core U.S. counterinsurgency manuals and handbooks, as well as a number of other supporting materials that have special bearing on counterinsurgency operations. And it's all sitting there. But very few people have actually dug into these documents.
Well, and so what'd you learn in those counterinsurgency manuals? Clear, hold, build, the way we could have won Vietnam if only the liberals hadn't sold us out?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Vietnam, because what I noted most about these manuals is that they're, you know, incredibly unsophisticated, and they rehash a lot of well-worn and not terribly effective material on guerrillas and conventional efforts to defeat guerrillas. It's really like reading a Vietnam-era manual. The thinking hasn't changed much, and, you know, as we can see from the results on the ground, the results haven't changed much either. You know, there's a counterinsurgency-related document there, from 2008, the U.S. Army's Unconventional Warfare Guide. And that document's typified by acronyms and a lot of jargon and gibberish on everything from U.S. national power and how it's perceived around the world to some, you know, just utterly false statements. One of the most egregious in there, quote a line from it: "The United States avoids resorting to military force, preferring to wield all other instruments of power in pursuit of national objectives." Now, this is quite obviously people from the Philippines, Nicaragua, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Afghanistan. I'm forgetting others, but, you know, they certainly dispute that assertion, the idea that the U.S. Doesn't like to and often doesn't resort to military force. And that's what these manuals peddle, a false version of U.S. history and a sanitized version of war that doesn't bear any relationship to what's actually going on the ground.
Well, I guess it is kind of fun, isn't it, to peek in the mind of what the people with the power tell each other. This is one thing that's been tripping me out lately, actually, is, and I guess I kind of knew this all along, but it's kind of hit me harder since I read The Good Soldiers by David Finkel. And, you know, there was nobody in that entire platoon, including Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarik, who had any idea what in the hell they were doing there or who they were supposed to be shooting at or why or who was on whose side in the war that they were in the middle of, that they were perpetrating. I mean, it was like their orders were the same line of BS in Bush's speech, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is what you find in a lot of you know, the military documents, they're confused and confusing.
Yeah. Well, and so no wonder they do such a horrible job at even committing acts of violence that they try to commit, you know? It's a disaster.
It is.
All right, so what else did you find in here?
Well, there's an interesting report called the Marine Corps Mid-Range Threat Estimate, 2005 to 2015. And they look back and forward. It's the Marine Corps Intelligence Global Threats Branch that put this out. And, there's a lot of material on there on how the Marines are evolving and they're adapting, developing agile strategies and new tactics for a new complex environment. But the most interesting part of it is an appendix at the end, which lists, as they put it, 20 states of interest that represent a range of potential future security challenges for the Marine Corps. And basically what it is a list of countries where the Marines think that there's a good chance they'll be deployed, and tells you a little bit about, how they would go about it, what type of, strategies they think would be used there. So, for people who are interested in keeping score over the next 5 years, the Marine Corps report forecasts that, counterterrorism missions by U.S. Marines are possible in places like Albania, Bangladesh, Colombia, Saudi Arabia. Possible is the mid-range on a three-point scale of likelihood that they use. They rate, also as possible counterinsurgency missions in Liberia, Syria, and Uzbekistan. When you look at the things that are rated high on the scale, they list counterterrorism operations in Ethiopia, Georgia, Mauritania, Nigeria, and they list, not surprisingly, Iran and North Korea as places where what they call major regional contingencies might occur, which is to say full-scale wars, like that being waged in Afghanistan.
Yeah, wow. Well, and the thing is, it's fun to you can just sit and go forever just speculating about the mindset, the premises of men who would write up a list like that. Albania, Bangladesh, for crying out loud. Imagine counterinsurgency in Saudi Arabia. And you know what? This is the one that you didn't type it this way, but I read it in italics, Nick, and that's Nigeria. America's going to Nigeria.
Well, I mean, the Marines certainly think it's a possibility there. So, it deserves attention.
Yeah, when the show first started in the beginning of 2007, I interviewed Sebastian Younger about his piece for Vanity Fair about the conflict there. And I've just kept my eye on that thing ever since. And the problem has certainly not gone away. The interests are still there, and they have a major problem with the locals who are resisting the outright theft of all their resources right out from under their village. At the same time, they put loot, the rivers, they can't even fish anymore where they live. And these people got guns, and they're not afraid. And there was even an Army recruitment ad that showed modern-day special forces in a boat in a, what is that, the Mekong Delta? No. Where are they? Where are they going? And they're in a muddy jungle river headed somewhere to kill people, and it looked like Nigeria to me. And, hey, I mean, I'm just speculating, but at somewhere in there, somebody came up with that scene. What are we going to have in this commercial? We want guys in a boat in a jungle looking maybe 2 or 3 years in the future with their just barely futuristic equipment on their way to this war. It looked like Nigeria to me, man.
Yeah, that's, it's part of the Marine Corps forecast there. By 2015, they see it as a possibility.
Man, amazing. And boy, can you imagine? You talk about a quagmire. It's a giant swamp, man. It's the Niger Delta, for crying out loud. Can you imagine just nothing but a bunch of John Kerry's in their boats killing people up and down those rivers? Man.
Yes, it's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah, well, so, tell us a little bit about the form of WikiLeaks, William. What people can find there, the country designations and all the wide and varied states at interest. Of course, some people even say, well, they must be CIA because they have so much about China and other countries that the Americans aren't down with.
It is a popular misconception about WikiLeaks. I've read on some right-wing sites where they say that it's simply U.S. government documents there. But as you say, on the other side, people say CIA because there's plenty of foreign government material there. And it's across the spectrum. There's things on China. There's secret Israeli government documents that are there on settlement building. There's Indian Army documents there. You name it, and it's easy to access. I mean, WikiLeaks is divided up by country. You can search by keyword through there. If it is a CIA operation, they have CIA documents there too, which are extremely interesting. You know, that's there's one on the site that came out this spring. About manipulating public opinion in Europe. It's, extremely interesting. And
elaborate on that one. That is extremely interesting and extremely important. In fact, that came up in conversation just the other day because I think it's the kind of point that you can sort of jab people with a little bit. So cynical, that thing.
Yeah, it was only a month after the Dutch government fell to anti-war sentiment at home and caused the... the pullout of Dutch troops, that this the CIA analytic team called Red Cell came up with a report which they titled Sustaining West European Support for the NATO-led Mission in Afghanistan. And basically the document, which was produced in collaboration with an agency public relations specialist and analyst from the State Department, outlined strategies for manipulating public opinion in France and Germany and other allied NATO countries. The report's classified, and not surprisingly, it's not to be shown to foreign nationals. And basically what it does is it highlights the fact that in France and Germany, there's been a great amount of public apathy about the war. So while a large majority of the population is against troop increases, they just haven't been paying attention, and that's allowed the national governments to disregard popular sentiment and steadily increase their troop contributions to the U.S. effort in Afghanistan. And what the CIA says is that there's a they had a great fear that this summer, with increased NATO casualties and this fall fears about more civilian casualties making into the press, would begin to undermine the war effort. And, they can't be more blatant than the way they put it. They say that the worst-case scenario is that as European elections approach, the Dutch troop withdrawal might cause, this is a quote, politicians elsewhere to cite a precedent for listening to the voters. So this is their great fear that... democracies of Europe will begin listening to the public.
I think it's kind of fun, too, because you're right. I mean, it's just the most cynical thing in the world in plain English, like you just say, unescapable. But also, it's revealing in how two-dimensional and stupid it is, right? Well, all we got to do is tell the French that, oh, boo-hoo, the women, we're going to protect the women. And all we got to do is tell the Germans, stand tall, be a man, and live up to your NATO obligations. And that's how we'll keep it. But, I mean, come on, like Germany and France aren't nations full of human beings? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, it goes back to this, as you call it, two-dimensional. Thinking that produces military manuals and CIA documents. It's no surprise that war efforts continue to go so poorly.
It's funny. I always like to think back on the dystopias and how to combine them all together. Like it's a little bit of We the Living and some 1984, and you definitely have lots of Brave New World mixed in here. And Brazil, that's what it's like. It's like the movie Brazil, a war being waged by these just nincompoops, man,
Yeah.
Robert De Niro, our hero, buried in paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what's going on.
Crazy. All right, well, it's going to come to an end one way or the other. Ron Paul always says, it's not going to come to an end because you listen to me. It's going to come to an end because we're broke. You can only take over the world so much before you run out of steam. And we're just bankrupting ourselves with this complex, with this mentality. And, I guess it's better than the alternative. You look at how the British and the Soviet Union lost their empires. You got to prefer that model to what happened to the Germans and the Japanese. You know, I guess sooner's better than later. Sooner lessens the risk of a war with Russia or some madness.
Yeah, but I mean, in any case, it won't be pretty.
Nah, it already isn't. It's already a nightmare. Nick, I really appreciate every bit of work that you do. I urge everybody to go and read Nick Terse. Look at his website. He's got links to all his articles there at The Nation, In These Times, of course, Tom Dispatch, The LA Times, The Village Voice, Alternet, and we feature much of what he writes at antiwar.com. I really look forward to reading your book about Vietnam, something I haven't been reading about lately, but you seem like just the guy to write a book that I'd like to read about it. So let me know when that comes out, would you?
I will, Scott. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.